Campus FM presents The Probe, produced and presented by Monique Chambers. Welcome to The Probe with me, Monique Chambers, and my guest this week is Professor Christian Zabradami, who is with the Faculty of Science here at the University of Malta. He's an astronomer who teaches nuclear physics and also the head of the Institute of Space Sciences and Astronomy. So, most people, like myself included, astronomers, we're going to think about our star signs, but what does a real astronomer actually do?
So astronomy is a very broad field in the sense that it's almost as broad as one would talk about the field of medicine. So astronomy basically breaks down into three or four subjects, but the three main ones are astronomy, astrophysics, and cosmology. Astronomy is more about, if you like it, in terms of a broad sense, the geography and the geographic positions of stars.
Okay.
And planets, mainly in our local galaxy, for example, the Milky Way. Astrophysics has more to do with how the stars shine and what makes a star shine and why a star shines compared to a planet, for example, which just reflects the light rather than produces light. And then cosmology is about the large scale structure of the universe, i.e. how galaxies are distributed inside the universe and why they are not just randomly distributed, but there are particular scales at which galaxies tend to cluster on the universe. So my job is basically more of a technical side of things, because what I do is I design and build radio telescopes in order to look for a very particular time in the universe, which is called the epoch of reionization.
Okay.
Which is a big word, but all it actually means is the time in the universe, about 400 million years after the universe was born, when the first stars started to form. So, if you like, what astronomers do is basically take snapshots in time of the universe. So if you imagine the universe, for example, like an unborn child, what we're taking is various ultrasounds at different times when the baby is developing. So the part I'm interested is when the first organs inside the baby are developing, or the first stars that then lead on to the first galaxies.
So how do you build something for these scans, essentially? How would you start?
So What we look for are tracers of molecules. So, for example, if everyone remembers, for example, your chemistry O level when you used to have the flame test, and, for example, potassium would burn red, for example, and other things would burn in green, like we see in the different colors of fireworks. In the same way, stars have different kinds of have different light according to their chemical composition. Like, for example, they might have hydrogen and helium. But the most common element, because it's the simplest one inside in the universe, is hydrogen, because that's just a simple atom. And this tends to emit light or emit waves at a frequency of about 1.4 gigahertz, which is very close to the frequency at which, for example, satellites work, like GSM and GPS. Not exactly, but very close. However, what happens is as the universe expands, this light gets stretched by the geometry of the universe as it's pulling the galaxies and everything inside it apart. So the wavelength, if you like, of this light changes and becomes at a lower frequency. So we look for example, at the epoch of reionization, we look for light or waves that are emitted at around 100 megahertz, which, as you know, is also very close to the frequency of this radio station. This is around 103.7 megahertz. So what we do is we build very big satellite dishes and antennas that people are used to having on their roof. We also need to go to extremely quiet and radio quiet locations, away from cities and away from other things. So what the first thing a radio astronomer does is basically look for a very, what we call, radio quiet site, far away in the middle of nowhere. So, for example, the Square Kilometre Array project, which we're building now, is in a place in Western Australia, just outside Perth, And just to give you an idea of how remote this place is, the area of our telescope is basically the size of Holland with only about 30 people living in it.
Wow.
So that's as remote as we can possibly find, you know. We have other sites in Antarctica, for example, and other sites that are, for example, high in the Chilean mountains. But those are more optical, where we want to be high up in the atmosphere so that we don't see too much of the atmosphere.
Okay. So how big are these dishes then that have to be in these
locations? Because of the frequencies we're looking at, there are two sets of dishes, or receivers as we call them, in the same way as you have, for example, as people have satellite dishes on their roof, which they use for satellite TV, and then they also have, as we used to have, the traditional antennas that were basically used in the relatively recent past. The dishes we design are 15 meters in diameter, okay, compared to what usually you have on your roof. It's basically maybe 50 centimeters diameter, so they're much larger. But what we have of these is we have 250 of these dishes, because what we're looking for are things that are obviously very faint radio signals from the earliest stars. So what we need is a larger collecting area in order to basically see these signals that are coming from further and further away. On the other hand, at the lower frequencies, we have the antennas that are very similar to the antennas you see on people's roofs still today. And at that frequency, because the light is even fainter, we basically have 250,000 of these antennas. So as you can imagine, you know, deploying 250,000 antennas in one of the most remote part of the world is a task unto itself, basically.
And how do you go about doing that? Because you were saying Australia, Chile, Antarctica. This isn't something just the University of Malta is working on, I'm assuming.
No, not at all. In fact, this is basically a partnership of about 20 countries and over 450 scientists working on this project, mainly coming from both the design side, the technical, electronic and engineering design, and then also working very much hand in hand with the scientists to get the specifications right to ensure that we are looking in the right regions of the universe, at the right places, at the right frequencies.
I'm imagining actually from space you'll be able to see your satellite farms, for want of a better.
I imagine so, yes.
That might be quite a nice picture actually to send back. So these antennas are listening, and Have you heard anything new? Have you seen something? Have you discovered anything
we're
yet?
We're still in the process of deploying these antennas. So we're projecting to put out our first, if you like, prototype in March 2017.
Okay.
And the project will then be built over 5 or 6 years up until March 2022. And then the telescope should work for about 20 to 50 years is the projected lifetime. And besides all this, of course, you know, when you build a telescope, what you're looking for is new things that we have not come across yet. So it is designed on purpose to be able to identify signals that we have not seen before, and also to look in places where we haven't been able to look in so much depth.
So you're designing the antennas here
at the University
of Malta. And you say you're designing them for something you haven't seen before.
That's right. Because what we're doing is, if you want to look at a telescope in a different way, is we're building a torch that shines onto the universe, that shines light onto the universe. So the brighter the torch, the more things we're expecting to find. So even though we don't know what we're looking for, all we know is that we're going to see further than we have ever seen before.
And how far are we talking? Just, you know, layman's terms.
In terms of far, so we tend to speak in terms of the time it takes for light to travel a certain distance.
Okay.
So if you like, light travels at a speed of 1 foot per nanosecond. So for example, when we look at the sun, we look at the light, it takes the light a couple of minutes, about 4 minutes to arrive at us. So we're looking at light that is originating from about 400 million years after the Big Bang. So we're looking at about 13 billion years ago. So the universe's age is about 13.7 billion years, so the light that comes from the beginning of the universe. So if you like, when, you know, the universe just started, so the cells, if you like, coming back to our baby, are still in meiosis, they're still reproducing at that level, is about 13.7 billion years old. And we're looking about 400 million years after that.
So what are you hoping to find in these...
What
are they? Not stars. In this dust? Space dust?
In this dust. Mm-hmm. At the time. It's mainly clouds of gas. Because what happens? A star is basically a ball of gas that is constantly burning, and the light that we see is basically the flame, if you like, of this gas that is burning. So what we're looking for is at the time of the universe where there was sufficient hydrogen so that the first stars could ignite, i.e. the first stars could shine. What does this mean? As soon as the first stars start to shine, they basically explode, and then they start creating non-linear parts of the universe. So it's no longer just a uniform cloud. Okay. If you like, stars are starting to form inside this cloud. In the same way, in a much more simplified way, raindrops start to form inside a cloud. These stars start to form. It's not the exact same physics. It's just an example. But as soon as these stars start to form, and then they start to explode and collapse, they start causing compressions and rarefactions in different parts of the cloud, which lead to more stars to form. And then as more stars start to form, then galaxies start to form around these stars, and then planets start to form around these stars, and then we get solar systems like our own.
So you're looking for other solar systems? Really?
We know that there are many other solar systems, okay. For example. So our galaxy has a few billion stars, and around these stars are most likely there are many other planets. So we've already found what are known as exoplanets, which are planets which basically orbit other stars. So, for example, one of the things that this telescope will be looking for is life on other planets. And how do we do this? Because we look again at the color of the light that comes from the atmosphere of other planets. So when people look at the Earth from, let us say, Mars, it looks blue. Right, because we can basically the sea and a lot of things. So we also look at the different colors, for example, to see whether there's water on other planets, whether there's carbon dioxide, whether there's oxygen, to look for signs of life or signs of possibly habitable planets.
That's life as we know it.
As we know it, that's right.
That sounds like a movie trailer. That is a movie line.
I think it is. Yes,
sounded very good. So. With this project, you said the first satellites or first antennas are going to be implemented any minute now, actually.
That's right.
We're coming up to
March, yes.
And so where's the first one going to be? Where's the first farm?
The first farm will be just out in Western Australia.
Okay.
And it's basically in the Murchison area, which, as I explained, is this very remote part in Western Australia.
So not all clamouring to go there. No. And it was just sort of mind-blowing, I have to say. So you're going to have a bunch of these antenna in a field, and then there'll be people monitoring the station, or they're not going to be close by, you can monitor from...
So there will be people on site, on the telescope site, but nowadays, basically, all the data that is collected from these antennas is piped to a central data processing system, which will probably be in Fremantle or in Perth itself.
Okay. And then the same for Chile and Antarctica?
That's right. So in Antarctica, there are actually people based at the station, at the South Pole, and in Chile also. But then what people do is that all the people that are over there are more technical people, making sure that all the antennas are working well and things like that. Nowadays, all the data is piped off onto the internet, and everyone just basically downloads their data set and plays with it in the comfort of their own home.
So we're looking to hear some great news out of this project in sort of 5 years' time, something along those lines?
I would imagine, yeah, we will start getting... We already have... interesting data from the precursors, which are telling us, you know, we're in the right places, we're looking in the right places, but we don't have quite the sensitivity we require in order to get to these faint signals. So what we're doing is, if you like, building more of the same and extending more of these things. The ones in Chile and Antarctica are complementary to the one that is in Western Australia, in the sense that they are looking for more complex molecules and hence at higher frequencies than what the one in Australia is, because the one in Australia basically looks for hydrogen.
Okay.
Whereas the ones in Chile and the Antarctica look for different molecules. For example, the one in Chile looks a lot for methanol and alcohols, which are also very, very, very simple molecules
that
you find there.
So I think I'm going to go
and work on that one. In Chile, yes.
But these satellites are all looking for something to back up one story, essentially?
That's right. The story of cosmology, of what we think happened at the early stages of the universe, and how these, as I explained before, galaxies and stars formed, and why we see the night sky as we see it today, why galaxies tend to cluster at various scales, which seem to have stemmed from these initial, if you like, fluctuations at the birth of the universe.
This must have blown your mind as a child, you know, when you see, you imagine the galaxy and then you think, what next?
And that's right, because cosmology over at least the last 10, 15 years has really grown. I remember when I started out at the field at university, people were arguing whether the universe was 10 billion years old or 15 billion years old. Now we're arguing whether it's 13.6 or 13.7 wow. billion years old. So we've really entered an era of precision science, of precision cosmology. We also know roughly, you know, there's 400 million or 450 million years after the Big Bang when the first started to form. But what we're interested in, and this is what science really always tries to pursue, is how these things happen. Was it cloud collapse that formed it? Was it X-rays? Was it black holes? Was it other things that started bringing the hydrogen together to form stars, to ignite, to form the first stars and galaxies?
So you trying to see as well if the end of our world is nigh, or is this?
No. That's quite a different. That's quite a different story.
I'm glad to hear that. Actually, I don't want to hear the rest of that story. Can you be working on anything else? Is there other things that you're involved with?
Yes, there are, because a lot of the things that we do in astronomy, which is looking for faint signals, and especially looking for signals that are buried in many other signals. So, for example, when we're talking about looking for the first stars, the signals are not only faint, but they're buried in also other very bright signals. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, whilst we're looking for something that is at 100 megahertz, we also have radio stations that are interfering with these things. So what we're doing is looking for and designing special filtering techniques to filter out the signals we don't really want to see, to find these really faint ones. Okay. And as a result of this, one of the projects that we're doing now at the University of Malta is applying these kind of filtering signals to look, for example, for small boats or small fishing vessels and things coming out of the Mediterranean, because when you have a radar system that is looking for boats, the smaller boats obviously have a much fainter signal compared to the large boat. So we're trying to apply these same techniques mm-hmm. of filtering out the large signals from the big boats to look for these small boats specifically.
Okay, and so that's being used? How's that being actually applied?
No, at the moment we're in the process of applying for funding for this project. And the idea behind this project is for search and rescue in the Maltese maritime waters.
Okay.
The idea being that it couples the idea that we have of our antenna design that we've done for the radio telescope and the signal filtering in order to filter out the large signals, in order to be able to not only detect these boats, but in order for us to then be able to send up a drone or a UAV to go over there and basically search and rescue in that area. This will give us confidence that our filtering techniques are working and that we are actually spotting the smaller mm-hmm. boats in a sea of clutter with waves, for example, and larger boats. But then the idea is to use, for example, these extended cameras that are now on drones, for example, like thermal imaging, in order to be able to carry out search and rescue at night.
Fantastic.
Whereas you can't see it optically because it's dark, you can still pick up the temperature of a human being, which is 37 degrees, compared to a sea that is 20 degrees, so that 17 degrees of temperature difference shines up at night.
Okay, so this is something that you're, again, working on here at University of Malta.
That's right.
To work in our waters and then
to work in our water.
Potentially replicate.
Yes, and then the idea would be that these systems would be based, you know, in Malta, in Lampedusa, in Pantelleria, in Sicily, in order to be able to cover a larger maritime area.
So what do these radars look like? These aren't the same sort of...
No, in fact, these radar systems probably look a lot like the one that is in Dingley. If you know that in Dingley, there's a coastal radar system run by the FAA.
The big golf ball.
The golf ball is there to protect the radar inside it. But this is the kind of things that they look like. And then the idea, as we mentioned, is that we would send up a UAV mm-hmm. or a drone, mm-hmm. as they're called. And to give visual follow up and feedback of the situation, does the AFM need to send a helicopter? Do we need to send a boat out there quickly?
So the information would be able to be received in a an easy to digest manner,
that's
so
right,
that you can
that's
quickly,
right.
quickly
exactly.
respond.
Quickly respond.
Excellent. Are there? What's next on your horizon?
From our perspective of the team of Malta, in Malta at the institute, we are three or four lecturers now. Mm-hmm. And we also have about 8 PhD students that are working both from the perspective of the antenna design, mm-hmm. and also will be coming out in March with me in order to deploy the first prototype. So we've worked on the antenna design, but also on the software backend that collects all the data,
okay.
that pipes it onto the internet for us to be able to then analyze the data from here in Malta.
And so I'm just thinking, as you're saying, there's 450 scientists working on this program. How do you manage that collaboration?
I think that's probably the most complex part of the of the telescope, managing the international politics and the collaborations of this. But what happens is that there are two meetings once a year, mm-hmm. a science meeting, which is where the scientists all meet and decide whether the science goals of the instrument are still aligned, they're still cutting edge, they're mm-hmm. still what people are looking for, and they kind of digest what the science that is coming out of the precursors. And then there's also an engineering meeting where different people meet to discuss how the different parts of the project join together. So, for example, we need to speak, for example, to the Australian infrastructure and local government in order for them to dig the trenches and build the roads
okay.
for us to put the antennas there, for the processing people, and, for example, to a power plant in order to build a solar power plant in order for us to be able to use the telescope and the batteries for the telescope to run at night, obviously.
So how long has this project taken so far? When did it start?
Well, that's also a very controversial thing to ask, I suppose, because everyone seems to think that they had this idea sometime in the 90s of building a very big telescope to look mm-hmm. for to look for hydrogen. But I think probably the first thoughts were 1990, around that.
Okay.
So it's a long process, you know, in order to get all the funding in place, to get all the governments to sign the agreements in order to be able to use their land and to use these systems.
This is such a huge, I mean, really a huge
It is.
Project.
I mean, the budget of the telescope stands at $650 million for construction.
Mm.
But then there is about 10% of that per year in running costs.
And then obviously you have to get it to where it has to be.
Exactly, and deploy it and commission it.
So are these actually made in Australia, or is this something you've actually had to ship in?
The different components of the telescope are made in different areas.
Okay.
So, for example, the electronic boards that read the antenna, so the equivalent of your set-top box that you have under your TV, are built in Italy at the moment. The software is made in Malta, and the antenna designs were made in Malta and are manufactured probably in China.
So the software's here at the University of Malta as well.
Right, yes.
That's really fantastic, actually. That was quite impressive. So, where do you fit into all this? How on earth did you get started on a project like this?
So I did BSc, if you like, a bachelor's in physics in Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did a PhD in the University of Cambridge as well in astronomy, where my PhD, if you like, involved mainly about image processing and deblurring images. So if you take photos, for example, with a blurred lens, so you're shaking whilst mm-hmm. your hand is shaking whilst you're taking photos, we came up with systems of filtering and bringing out the best of that image, which basically was very important for things like the Hubble Space Telescope and was used in projects like that. From that, however, then I worked in industry. So I worked at S3 Microelectronics,
okay.
both in Malta and in Edinburgh, where I designed cameras for mobile phones. So basically our job was to design the sensors and the autofocus algorithms, if you like, that basically helps you with these things. After that, my PhD supervisor and his group moved from Cambridge to Oxford in order to start working on this project, the Square Kilometer Array. And basically they contacted me and said, would you like to come and lead this project in digital signal processing and the software behind the focusing of the telescope and bringing all these antenna signals together in order to form the image? And I ended up there in 2010.
Okay.
And I've been working in it for 7 years.
And so now you sort of flit around.
That's right.
Working with
Oxford.
That's
right. So I work both in Oxford and the Malta. So this was a thing that also helped me collaborate and also helped may bring students from Malta to Oxford and vice versa in order to work together as a larger team in order to deliver this telescope.
And so when you were a child, I'm just imagining how interesting it must have been for your parents to keep you occupied. But I'm guessing you were really into space and physics and
I was. I mean, obviously I was very lucky in the sense that my dad was also a scientist and a professor of chemistry here at the university. So I was kind of always encouraged in the science world, if you see what I mean. And I kind of almost trod in my dad's footsteps almost all the way. He also did a PhD in chemistry in Oxford, and I've ended up in Oxford. He also taught here, and I teach here. So the apple didn't fall very far from the tree all along the way.
Don't tell Newton. I was just going to say, you know, they're struggling to get children interested in science today. Is it, do you think, that there's science in their hands and we're just not seeing it as science?
I think Malta has made a very big and very good step with now Explora, the science museum that's open. It's opened in Kalkara. Mm-hmm. And the idea is it's a science museum which I really like, because the concept is that a lot of the exhibits, if not all of them, are all interactive. So it's hands-on science for children to learn about effects like waves, for example, and like the weather. And what this means is that, you know, the idea and the concept of a scientist in a lab coat with crazy hair and blowing things up is far removed from what scientists do nowadays. It's much more of an interactive, of an understanding of what goes on around us and how it goes on around us.
So we should visit Explora, and we should get our kids in excited. And I'll just confirm, just as we wrap up, with Professor Christian Zabradami, he's not a mad professor lookalike that you imagine, but absolutely fascinating. Slightly over my head there, but thank you very much for joining us here on this week's Probe.
You have just listened to The Probe, produced and presented by Monique Chambers.